I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the 21st anniversary edition of the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the prolific and distinguished author Jerome Charon, discussing his new book, Ravage and Son. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. My friends, today we're celebrating the 21st anniversary of the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends. That's me. This is a milestone, of course, as all anniversaries are, but in particular, because now that we are 21 years old, we are finally eligible to buy a drink. Not that being younger than 21 has stopped us until now, but now it's officially okay. So in that spirit, or spirits.
Soll sein mit Glück l'chaim, 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 soll sein, soll das sein leben.
L'chaim indeed, to life. It's a good day to toast our more than two decades of radio and podcast excellence. In this, our nearly 1100th show. It's show number 1099, if you are scoring at home, which means 21 years of great guests, Jewish insight, Torah, music, the most relevant news, and allegedly humor. Now, 21 is a powerful number in Judaism. It's not the classic accomplishment of some mere multiple of 10, like last year's 20th anniversary celebration, but the more mystically powerful multiple of the very Jewish number 7 times the also Jewish number 3. 7 represents the days of creation in Bereishit, Genesis, and the 7 days of the week, while 3 is the number of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. 7 is also an important number in Kabbalah, Jewish mystical teachings, representing the central sefirot, the divine emanations that orient and structure the universe in the Zohar. It is that flow of energy that allows life to exist. And so, as we say again, I am often told it must be very difficult to do the Two Jewish Radio Show for 21 years now. And how do I manage it, since I'm a full-time congregational rabbi, as well as a husband, father, son, saba, and so on? It must be a true labor of love, right? Well, it's true, it's not exactly easy to continue our long Two Jewish tradition of radio and podcast excellence, but it is certainly a labor of love. And the Jewish world never fails to keep us sharp and fresh with its never-ending dynamism, diversity, controversies, and idiosyncrasies. While there are occasional times when it's hard to find a new old Jewish joke of the week, I mean, they are old Jewish jokes of the week, right? And it takes time to wade through all the great Jewish music we get to choose between for the cuts that we play. There are always Jewish ideas and innovations to discuss, explore, and of course, critique. Judaism has been around for 3,800 years or something like that, and the fact that it keeps evolving has made it a force for good in the world for nearly 4 millennia of vital life. How can we do less than entertain, educate, and seek to inspire for an hour each week on Two Jewish? And isn't that something to truly celebrate?
God would like us to be joyful even when our hearts lie panting on the floor. How much more can we be joyful when there's really something to be joyful for? To life, l'chaim.
And so here we are at age 21, and we would do a disservice if we neglected our traditional play-in for this, our anniversary show. After all, Judaism is always about the interplay of tradition and innovation, the way in which we shape our own experience of our religion, heritage, and culture for our own era, drawing on the amazing storehouse of Jewish wisdom, history, holidays, and civilization to make it all relevant for ourselves and our descendants. And, of course, right here, our wonderful listening audience, you all. So, to play us in formally on this 21st anniversary show of Two Jewish, here's Meir Machtenberg's classic Shehecheyanu, reviving the tradition again. The prayer for all new and good things, this time a rendition by the Zamir Chorale of Boston. That was Meir Machtenberg's classic Shehecheyanu, the prayer for good new things, as we celebrate our 21st anniversary of Two Jewish right here this morning. I cannot help but reflect on some of the amazing guests we've had on Two Jewish over the years. They've run the gamut from great guests like Ed Asner and Ehud Barak and Elie Wiesel of blessed memory, to very funny ones like Kinky Friedman and Robert Klein and Richard Lewis, to prominent rabbis like Adin Steinsaltz, to great authors, poets, politicians, scholars, and athletes, and the leaders of all the major movements of contemporary Judaism. We've had the chance every week to talk to people shaping the Jewish world and to Jews shaping the whole world, and we intend to continue to do so as long as God gives us the energy, health, and funds to do so. It's been a great 21 years of Two Jewish. I hope the next 21 years are even better. Our guest on this 21st anniversary celebration of Too Jewish this morning, Jerome Charon, is a distinguished author of over 35 books and many other literary works. His new novel, Ravage and Son, explores the milieu of the Lower East Side of New York in the early 20th century, an incredibly Jewish place. And Jerome Charon will tell us why his remarkable murder tale is set there. Find out all about it when he joins us in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning. Jerome Charon has crafted a remarkable novel. It's called Ravage and Son, and it's, I'll let you tell us about it. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Well, thank you so much, Rabbi. Well, I grew up on the Lower East Side and always wanted to write a novel about what I saw and experienced as a child, because my grandparents lived on the Lower East Side, and I saw a certain sadness that touched me and a kind of poetry in the poverty, and this is what I wanted. So I put a modern Jekyll and Hyde story, it's a crime story of a man who sort of takes advantage of prostitutes, and I wanted to sort of, I have a detective who goes after him, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really the ambience of the place. The place takes precedence over the character.
Yeah, I think you do a beautiful job of kind of reviving that world, you know, long before it was the new Chinatown and then gentrified and so on. Tell us why you started with Abraham Cahan, the famous editor of the Foreword, who really, he's not the protagonist, but he plays a huge role in this story.
Well, when I was a child, I passed the Foreword building. My parents, my grandparents lived one block behind it on Henry Street. And Cahan was a fascinating character. He was a revolutionary in Eastern Europe. He came to the United States. He learned the English language. He was a socialist at a time when the word socialism, you know, was not a word that you could use anymore. But there was a belief, which was very important to me, that one took care of other people. And this is no longer true. We live in a world which is a Trumpian world, which is almost the exact opposite, where to help other people is almost a kind of sin.
The Lower East Side was the most crowded place in the world before World War One. Yeah, or Calcutta, you know, you could call it the black hole of the Lower East Side. It was the melting pot, but it was more than that. It was a complicated, but also a filthy, crowded, dangerous place. How did you go back to that? I mean, I've been to the Tenement Museum, I took my kids there and so on, but even that's a little bit sanitized, isn't it?
It is sanitized, but even though the Lower East Side has been gentrified, and everything in New York has been gentrified because the real estate prices are so high, if you look at the roof lines of some of those buildings, you can see what it must have been like. And when Cahan looks from the 10th story of his building upon the Lower East Side and he sees the red dust coming off the buildings, you can try to understand what the Lower East Side was about. It was a place in transition. We have suddenly automobiles and shopping centers, et cetera, et cetera. And Ridley's was the great shopping sort of emporium of the Lower East Side, and that's where some of the immigrant Jews would go. and learn how to dress, because what's so moving about the Lower East Side is that the immigrants who came here passed through Ellis Island, which was a horror show.
Right. I mean, if you go there now, it's a national park, but it wasn't like that when they were going through.
No, it was horrible. They were poked around, and if they had any kind of disease, they were
sent back.
Yeah. Not only sent back, sometimes they stayed there for 6 months until they could be sent back. So
right.
They were treated miserably, and in some sense, I was moved by what I saw as a child, and it remained with me, so that the ambience, the aroma, is always there, and this is what I try to recapture.
We will talk much more with best-selling author and distinguished author, I should say, Jerome Charon, about his book, Ravage and Son, when we come back in a moment on this 21st anniversary edition of Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. It's almost time for school. Religious school, Hebrew school registrations open now for all school-age children or grandchildren. Join us for the fifth year of our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting of great Jewish learning. Go to Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night or Saturday morning. Email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us every Friday night in person or on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. with full music. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. Torah study precedes them at 9 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is BeitSimchaTucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and they are extensive, are live and on Zoom. Access those by emailing rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org or just signing up at our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too, some students live and some on Zoom, and we're starting up August 20th. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to our services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and our outreach programs, This is Judaism and the Hebrew Marathon, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners. with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean, on Spotify, too. Post a rating. Please review 2Jewish where you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we've been talking the last couple of weeks doing, as you put it so eloquently in your much better French, a tour d'horizon, a view of all of the developing Jewish communities in the world, whether they were connected to what was there before or not. And we kind of forgot a couple of continents almost. Let's talk a little bit about some of the really interesting Jewish communities that are actually emerging and growing in Africa.
Okay, sure. It was an oversight that I think is repeated frequently among Jews in that we only think of other Jews as people who look like us.
Yeah.
So people who look completely different from us,
right,
we tend to assume are either not Jewish at all or they're not real Jews, whatever that means.
It's definitely a problem. I mean, the whole kind of Jews of color movement in the United States is based on that, but you don't have to be in the United States to find this.
Right. So Africa has a number of different Jewish communities, each of which is viewed by the state of Israel in different ways in terms of citizenship and the law of return and all that. They pretty much concluded that Ethiopian Jews are the real deal. And so lots of Ethiopians have made aliyah and are finding places in Israeli society in a wide variety of roles.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. When I was living in Israel, I worked in a absorption center, Americas Klita, for Ethiopian Jews for the better part of a year and organized some Hebrew Union College students to do it. And it was Israelis loved Ethiopian Jews now. They don't necessarily think that way anymore now that they're part of Israeli society, right? But it's pretty clear they're Jews.
Right. So then there are other communities that are growing by leaps and bounds in places like Uganda, Nigeria, Ghana. And the lineage or the history of those Jewish communities and their authentic ties to Jews of biblical times is more widely questioned than that of Ethiopian Jews. There are some training programs in Europe and the United States that train rabbis and cantors for those Jewish communities, but Israel doesn't seem to consider them candidates for citizenship immediately. So whether that's just because they don't look like us or for some other historic reason, which probably hasn't been sufficiently researched, they may all be people who sort of converted themselves in the last 50 years and aren't really part of a long ancestral rabbinical tradition. An interesting thing to think about on this particular question of Jews in Africa is where there were colonial communities that were thriving, Jews from the colonizing country came and settled. So South African has a lot of Jews of British origin. And Dakar used to have Jews of French origin. They were traders, merchants. They were like Jews in the Old South. They ran department stores. That community is just about gone because Senegal took a hard right into Islam. But the other communities I mentioned, Nigeria, Uganda, and Ghana in particular, are interesting because they're all former British colonies. And it may be that the European type of anti-Semitism that the French brought with them to Africa and their colonial ventures wasn't carried by the English, so that locals saw it as only an advantage to become Jewish and thereby closer to the colonizers.
You know, it's a fascinating area. I know people from Jews from Uganda, which is a newer community, meaning 140 or 50 years ago it got started. It's not yesterday. And I also have friends who are from Cape Verde, which has a very interesting kind of Portuguese Sephardic Jewish background. So very interesting areas. And well, we're talking about maybe next time we will go to Asia. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. Brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An old Jewish couple, Morty and Sally, are eating breakfast while reading the news. Morty comes upon a study that says women use more words than men. Excited to demonstrate to his wife his long-held contention that women in general and his wife in particular talk too much, Morty shows Sally the study results, which says men use about 15,000 words per day, but women use 30,000. Sally thinks about it for a while, then finally says to Morty, "That's because we have to repeat everything we say." And Morty replies, "What?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Re'eh, the fourth Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy, which follows a sequence of marvelous Torah portions with yet another remarkable text. Re'eh includes one of the most radical statements in the whole of the Torah, Ki yihyeh v'cha evyon me'achad achecha be'achad sha'recha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates in the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. Ki fatoach tiftach et yadcha lo. You shall certainly open your hand to him, giving him whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. The commandment is not simply to provide for the needs of the needy, not just to alleviate suffering, but to give them what they actually want, sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our American society, in which the safety net seems to have as many holes as net. It is a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand and surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of the strong economic agenda of Deuteronomy, Dvarim. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power, but no one is to be left destitute. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need in order to survive. Herein lies a foundational lesson on the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion, give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity, and to do so in a way that preserves the dignity of the recipient. That's the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly and righteously. Judaism at its heart is pragmatic ethics. We're trained to make the world morally better through practical action. After exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity must give something to those with even less, the rabbis conclude that tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of your income, not a hard and fast figure, and that the same percentage, whether 10% or 5% of gross income or some other number, should be given even in good times and in bad, even in crazy, strange times. It's true that when there is less income, there will be a smaller absolute amount donated, but the percentage, and thus the integrity of the individual's morality, must be preserved. So open your hand. Give a percentage of your gross income to help others. Do so freely and generously in good times, in tough times, at all times. It's the Jewish thing to do. It's the right thing to do. When we return in a moment, our guest this morning, renowned author Jerome Charon, explains why he set his new novel, Ravage and Son, in the Lower East Side before World War I, and how he writes his remarkable works of fiction, and how writing for him, just like reading, is a profoundly Jewish art. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A Palestinian terrorist shot and wounded five people at a hamburger restaurant in the Israeli West Bank area of Maale Adumim before an off-duty policeman shot him dead. One man was seriously injured and four had moderate wounds in the terror attack last week. The policeman was getting a haircut at a barber shop in the same shopping area and shot the terrorist as he tried to escape after his atrocity. Maale Adumim, one of the larger quote-unquote settlements in the central West Bank, is in reality a suburb of Jerusalem. The attacker, a cleaner there, had permission to enter Maale Adumim. The attacker, the terrorist, was from the nearby Palestinian town of Al-Azariya. In Pennsylvania, the jury has given the Pittsburgh synagogue shooter a death sentence, handing down the maximum punishment for the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in American history. The sentence marks an end to the months-long trial of the extreme right-wing terrorist convicted in June of murdering 11 Jews during Shabbat morning prayers, October 27, 2018. The shooting at a synagogue in the historically Jewish neighborhood of Squirrel Hill changed the way we Jews across the U.S. view ourselves and perhaps our place in American society. It was a stark example of a rising tide of anti-Semitism and led Jewish institutions across the country to bolster their physical security in many ways. The gunman's lawyers had not contested his guilt, but argued that the act was a result of his mental illness and did not merit a death sentence. The jury rejected that argument, deciding unanimously he should be put to death. Many of the victims' families, though not all, had pushed for the gunman to receive a death sentence. The sentence makes this the most prominent person condemned to death for anti-Semitic crime since, well, Adolf Eichmann, I suppose, convicted and executed in Israel in 1962 for his role perpetrating the Holocaust. In more obscure Jewish news, a new document dump in the ongoing declassification of President John F. Kennedy's documents, boy, revealed the identity of the CIA screener assigned to Lee Harvey Oswald for 18 months before the assassination. Oswald, of course, was the assassin who murdered JFK. The agent was a man named Reuben Efron, a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, a Jewish immigrant from Lithuania. Going into Efron's Jewish identity doesn't answer the questions posed by JFK conspiracy theorists, but it does reveal that Efron not only worked as a U.S. spy, but had a deep knowledge of the spies in the Torah. It turns out Efron spent time living in Israel before he died November 22, 1993. That's exactly 30 years to the day after Kennedy's assassination, for all you conspiracy theorists out there. While there, he contributed 5 articles back in the 1970s to a publication called the Jewish Bible Quarterly, a World Zionist Organization-affiliated publication based in Jerusalem. It channeled his expertise in espionage. He reflected in them on such subjects as Rahab and the spies in Joshua's invasion of Canaan, and the original 12 spies in Moses' time, and similar espionage subjects. Efron was born in Lithuania in 1911 and attended a Jewish high school there, a Hebrew gymnasium. He followed that by attending and graduating from university in what is now Kaunas, Lithuania. He practiced law for 5 years in that city, a thriving hub of Lithuanian Jewish life. It became the site of the country's largest ghetto under the Nazis, before escaping to the United States, emigrating in December 1939, coming into Miami via Cuba. U.S. immigration documents list Efron's profession as a salesman. According to a family history compiled by a relative, that fall he went to Atlanta Law School and worked at a clothing store in downtown Atlanta until he graduated from law school in 1943. Efron spoke Russian, Lithuanian, Hebrew, Yiddish, and German, and of course English, and he enlisted in the Air Force during World War II as an interpreter. After the war, he played a role in some peace negotiations and in talks related to the resettlement of war refugees, among them members of his own family, tragically not his mother, who was murdered in the Holocaust. For decades, Efron worked for the U.S. government, playing roles that are only now coming to light as secret government documents are being made available to the public. His family history says Rubin worked for the Pentagon. In addition to his now-revealed role, reading Oswald's mail for a year and a half, Efron pops up in another declassified document dealing with another area of amateur sleuthing that has garnered a following as intense as the Kennedy assassination. In October 1955, Efron was traveling by train in the Soviet Union with U.S. Senator Richard Russell, the Georgia Democrat, and a senior U.S. Army official. The three men reported seeing 2 circular, unconventional aircraft resembling flying discs or flying saucers, taking off almost vertically a minute apart. After the sighting, Soviet trainmen became excited and lowered curtains and refused permission to look out windows, says the 1955 report. That one was declassified in 2004. U.S. observers firmly believe these unconventional aircraft are flying saucers or disc aircraft. Wow. Efron later split his time between Israel, where he was admitted to the bar as an attorney, and the U.S. after he retired from the CIA. We still don't know what he read in Lee Harvey Oswald's mail in the year and a half leading up to the Kennedy assassination. But it is interesting to wonder about and to be impressed by Efron's complex, espionage-inflected Jewish life's journey. And that's the 2 Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the 2 Jewish. Our guest this morning, Jerome Charon, has been called by no less than Michael Chabon, one of the most important writers in American literature. He has published, I guess, more than 50 books over the 50 years he has been writing. He's perhaps most famous for his work in detective fiction with Isaac Seidel, the kind of key Jewish detective. And in his new book, Ravage and Son, he takes us back to the Lower East Side. And, well, it as you noted earlier, it's kind of a Jewish Jack the Ripper. I don't know, Jacob the Ripper?
In other words, there's a prelude where you see the character, how he's been himself mistreated, and then he turns into a kind of Jekyll and Hyde and romps around, you know. Allen Street was the red light district of the Lower East Side in the early 20th century. And what is distressing to me, what is most distressing to me, and is that young women really had no place to go. They couldn't be educated. They either worked in a sweatshop, or they got married at a very early age and had children that became mothers. But they, to me, the education is the key to everything, and they didn't have a chance to educate.
You know, I was reminded a little bit reading the book of the old film Once Upon a Time in America about Jewish gangsters on the Lower East Side.
Yeah, wonderful film. I hope you saw the uncut version.
That's a very good question. I don't know. I saw it a long time ago, and then I watched it again on Netflix when
the cut version is a piece of junk. The uncut version, which is over 3 hours, is
Yeah, it was long, so I think it was the uncut version I got. And a lot of non-Jews playing Jews, which seems to be the way things work in the movies these days. But, we like to think about our noble ancestors coming here and working their way up from poverty and becoming, going to Columbia like you did, and either that or raising themselves up in commerce or whatever it is, and becoming successful and Americanized, and always working hard and maybe going to shul on occasion. That's not the milieu that you're digging into here.
No, and that was not the case. I mean, Kahan himself believed in assimilation and knew that he tried to get young Jewish men to go to City College so that, knowing that they would leave the Lower East Side, but out of poverty, got crime, and it was a haven for Jewish gangsters, and particularly pickpockets, and Jewish crime, really cast a terrific shadow over the Lower East Side, but crime in a very different way, because the police themselves were attached to crime. If you remember, there's Essex Market Street Courthouse, which is really a courthouse where young Jewish men or women are arrested and then pay terrible fines for having committed no crime at all. So there was the people were taken advantage of, and the young man, Ben Ravitch, who's a lawyer from Harvard, instead of, joining an illustrious firm in Manhattan, he goes back to the Lower East Side and tries to protect some of these people who were taken advantage of by the police. So there was no escape route. For many people, they were born into poverty, they lived in poverty, and died in poverty. And that's the great sadness.
I'm fascinated. I've always loved detective fiction. And gosh knows you've worked in that genre for many years in many ways. I think some of it rises really to the level of great literature, but it's really seen as genre writing, isn't it? You've written in many different styles.
I never saw it as genre. I saw it as literature. So therefore, they were not, quote, popular successes, because they didn't have the usual, beginning, middle, and end. They were about crime, but they were not crime stories. And Ravage and Son is also a crime story. But, I hate to use the word literature, but when I use the word literature, I mean that it's problematic. It doesn't solve problems. It tries to get the reader to understand what problems were. So it asks questions more than it could ask.
The art of writing, I think it was Ring Lardner who first said, it's very easy. You sit down at a typewriter until blood comes out of your forehead.
Absolutely, more than the forehead.
Your fingers, your soul.
Yeah, you put everything. As a matter of fact, when you're writing a novel, that is the reality life. And my cat and my wife, I love them, but in some real sense, nothing exists except the words on the page and the characters you're trying to make live on the page. And this is all you have. This is the gift that you have, to create a world out of nothing, out of what's in your mind. And to recreate from Lower East Side what it must have been like in 1913, I really wanted to do this, and it took me a very long time. I wrote this over a period of 10 years. You know, I had many versions of the draft, and originally it was more of a first story. I didn't want it to really run it. So with the criminal, you know, Lionel Hampton, is revealed from the very beginning. And then it's a question, what do you do about it?
You know, the Lower East Side, as you noted, look, your book is very Jewish. You've written in deeply Jewish milieus. Is that, and yet you've also written as Emily Dickinson about the least Jewish person in the history of America. How influential is your own background in what you create? Because obviously you can work at any venue. You lived in France. I mean, you live in France.
I see Jewishness in a special way. I see it as a kind of morality. I don't see it beyond the fact that one has to have a kind of virtue of belief in trying to put the world of poverty. Also, education is very, education saved my life. I came from a very poor family, but I was able to go to the best school in America. It made very well school, I don't even know. But it made one feel that books were holy, that they were holy instruments, and that when you picked up a book and you read it with Dostoevsky or Clemens Joyce or Franz Kafka, there was something that was given to you that was almost a spirituality that was beyond commerce. Books were not about commerce. They were not about bestsellers. They were not about, you know, earning fortunes. They were about learning a craft. About telling the story and moving the reader to tears. That's what I want to do. I want the reader to die with the book, to die with the feeling of the book. That was my only purpose and my only thing. It is not commerce. It's not anything other than a spiritual quest.
There is something profoundly Jewish about that. As you note, I mean, we talk about ourselves as the people of the book, but really it should be the people of the books. It's a plural term. It's not just the Bible. It's so
people
many.
People of the faith, or people of goodness, of belief in that, and the desire to help other people. To me, that's very important, so that I also need to help poor people and make sure that they are able to go to school, because education changed my life. And I think it's critical. It's critical to me. I don't know how to be a rabbi, but to me, education is the thing that I don't care what happens after you go to school. And I know very bad people have had good educations and have turned out to be very cool and very mean. But on the other hand, I didn't feel that way. I went to the best school that there was for the purpose that I had, which was to learn the craft of writing. And for me, it was a religious experience.
The character of Ben that you created, can we expect to see him again?
No, you won't see him again, because as you can see by the end of the book, his mind is already ruined. But I always wanted to go to Harvard, you know, but I never dared apply to the school. So I always have my character go to Harvard, you know, so that I can experience what didn't happen to me. But what's interesting about Ben is that he become commercial in any way, but believes in helping people. That's his quest. It's not simply to find this man and ravage women, but young women to remove them from prostitution. So that is where I see my Jewishness.
As a form of tikkun olam, no doubt, as a form of trying to improve the world, perfecting the world, seeking that spiritual perfection, or at least improvement.
Not perfection, but spiritual help.
Spiritual help.
The rabbi, you know, when I teach a class, I consider myself a rabbi. You know, I'm on a spiritual quest, even though I'm teaching films. It's always about a moral dilemma. It's always about everything, every film I teach. I always turn it into a kind of moral dilemma.
Any good film has a moral dilemma worked out.
Absolutely.
Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, and study and learning is above all. It leads to everything good that we can find. I want to thank Jerome Charon for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and your extraordinary books and Ravage and Sons?
Well, you can look at Wikipedia, and you can go to Amazon, or and you can go to my website, jeromecharon.com, if you want to learn more about me. Or you can write me on my site. There's an email address if people want to write me. I mean, I'd be very happy to answer any question about literature, about writing, about films, about the world, about my cat, about my wife, about yourself, anything.
Well, I maybe our cats will meet someday.
I hope so.
We have two. One is named Zohar and the other is named Puck. So they're kind of literary cats.
My cat is called Quetzal.
Quetzal. That's somehow more Jewish than even Zohar. Thank you. Thank you so much, Rob. It's a great pleasure to have you on this 21st anniversary edition of Too Jewish.
Thank you so much. Congratulations on the anniversary.
Thank you. When we come back in a moment, we'll hear more about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on this celebratory edition.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on the 21st anniversary edition of Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Lisa Niver, travel podcaster, a top 3 travel influencer in the world on social media, and the author of Brave-ish, 1 Breakup, 6 Continents, and Feeling Fearless After 50. And please join us at Congregation Beis Simcha every Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. And don't miss the Hebrew Marathon. Learn how to read Hebrew in 2 days, guaranteed, August 13th and 14th. And then our This Is Judaism pre-introductory dip your toe in the water, learn about Judaism class. All of that's available on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. My friends, have a Shavua Tov. Oh, wait, I forgot to play us out this morning. Don't want to forget that. As a final celebration of our 21st anniversary, here's a group called Chicago Acapella with a final Shehecheyanu, a prayer for all good and new things and accomplishments. You know, like your 21st anniversary of Too Jewish. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.